This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
As an author, Charles Finch has made a name for himself with the Charles Lennox Mystery Series, publishing a book each year since the series was launched in 2007, including the most recent, The Woman in the Water, which was published in February. But he's also made a name for himself as a book critic, with reviews published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, the Guardian, USA Today, Slate, the New Yorker Online, and many more. Earlier this year, he was awarded the Nona Balakian Citation for Excellence in Reviewing for the 2017 National Book Critics Circle Awards. Charles joined me at the KMUW studios recently to discuss the balancing act between author and critic. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. So in 2007, your first book in this series featuring Victorian gentleman and amateur detective Charles Lennox was published. It was titled A Beautiful Blue Death. Fast forward 11 years, and 11 books have been published in the series. The last one, published just this month, is The Woman in the Water, and it's actually a prequel to the Charles Lennox series. Set in May of 1850, and it opens on Charles's 23rd birthday. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
So with 10 books already out in the series, what prompted the decision to go back and write about Lennox's first case?
Well, writing a series is an interesting experience. You get to know this universe of characters, and it's the same reason I love reading series. You get to visit with the same character once a year and sort of see how they grow and what they've become. But it's also a long journey at close quarters. Like, I've been writing about the same characters for 10 years. And I was kicking around ideas with my editor, and we thought, well, how could we sort of reinvigorate my interest in the series after 10 books? And he suggested a prequel, and I just immediately, it sparked something. And I thought, oh, that would be so interesting to go back and look at all my notes from 2007 and when I was an innocent young writer who didn't know how to do anything. And I went back and I just was filled with ideas. And it was also appealing to write about someone who's a little newer and more less established and more anxious about what's going to happen in his career, about a young person.
Now, for those who like to judge books by their covers, if you were to go back and look at A Beautiful Blue Death and the September Society and the Fleet Street Murders and so on, they are visually connected by a trio of items on each cover. But this last book, the first chronologically, it has a very different look to its cover. Was that intentional?
What's really funny about that is that it has a painting on it by a Victorian painter named John Atkinson Grimshaw, which is of a lady standing by the Thames at dusk. And when A Beautiful Blue Death came out in 2007, I was 26, and they said, what do you want for a cover? And I said, I want a painting by John Atkinson Grimshaw. And they said, no, that's not a good idea. So for 10 books, I obediently had three objects on every cover. And then this time they said, we have a really great idea for a cover. There's this painting by John Atkinson Grimshaw. And I said, okay, if you really think so, I guess we can go with that. That's a good idea, I guess. I love how it turned out. It's sort of this nice, lovely blue color and to me, hints at some of the mysteries in the book.
That's fantastic. My face should probably be six shades of embarrassed right now, but I have to be honest and admit that I only read the prequel. And I'm a little bit thrilled to be meeting Charles Lennox while he tackles his first case. And you have fans of the entire series and first-time readers like me, probably. What do you hope that each will come away with?
I think my hope was that it would be really rewarding for people who love the series, because I feel a lot of fidelity to those people, especially the ones who started early. So not you. I'm just kidding. No, I think I want them to have lots of little Easter eggs. So, for instance, there are characters who pop up who are longstanding parts of the series, and one of them might be 4 years old, or one of them might appear under a different guise. But I also wanted it to be just readable for itself, to be its own book about a young detective starting out in London in 1850 when no one even really knew what police were or what a detective was.
I was wondering if fans of the entire series, do they get to learn new facts or plot points to reinforce or maybe explain something that has happened later on? Or are they reminded of what's to come?
Yes, for sure. There's especially for, I have some fans who know the books more intricately than I do, who have read them multiple times, and I tend to forget. People come up to me and say, oh, you did a great job with Mr. Carruthers, and I say, oh, what book was that again? I can't remember. But so for them, I tried to put in as much of the 10 books that are set later in Charles Lennox's life as I could to try to make it a richer experience. But as I say, I wanted it to be a mystery also just for first-time readers who would feel welcomed to a new series.
This book ends with, you know, cases being solved, but there's still a question. Does that question remain? Does it tie throughout the books?
That does not end. Well, it's a complicated answer. It's a great question. I like to leave in a lot of my books something slightly open-ended because as much as I love the model of the mystery novel where everything is tidied up and returned to order, I also like the sort of ongoingness of life, which is why my characters age and have children and sometimes unexpectedly die or get sick. So I wanted to leave room for myself to keep writing about someone who maybe escapes capture at the end of this book.
Does Charles Lennox share any traits with Charles Finch?
Oh, that's such a good question. I often think of something that novelist Haruki Murakami said, which is they asked him, who are your protagonists? And he said, imagine if I had a twin brother and we were separated at birth and he was sent to the other side of the country and he grew up and he wasn't a writer. He was just, you know, became a doctor or a dentist or a grocery salesperson or whatever he became. So we're the same, but we're a little different. So I feel like that about Lennox. Like part of me is an old man living in 1850s London, and obviously part of me is not, but he feels like my sort of lost twin, not identical, but out there.
Are you a cat person?
I love cats, but my wife is allergic. What am I supposed to do? It's really bad.
You have them in books. And I only asked because there were cats in the Lennox book.
Yeah.
And then you also mentioned cats in your review of Ursula K. Le Guin's No Time to Spare, which ran in the Tribune. Is that the Chicago Tribune?
That's right, yeah.
And it just cracked me up because Lennox, when the cats were introduced and he said he was only going to refer to them as cat. I have a cat named Cat.
Named Cat?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
And my daughter even started a Twitter account. It's Kat Golay. And she gets to say some things that I don't get to. So it's kind of nice.
Great. Everyone follows Kat Golay.
Are you a rower?
I am not a rower, and I shouldn't be allowed near boats. I'm the kind of person who would fall off. But I am an exerciser. And so I think what you're referring to is in this book, yeah. To when he's really confused or perplexed about a clue, he goes off and rows. And I sometimes find that I'll be at the worst, have the worst feeling a writer can have, which is plot confusion. And I'll go for a hard run or something and I'll come home and it'll be solved behind my back. Like my brain will have done the work while I was thinking about other things. So I wanted to recapture that experience.
Have you shot trap?
What an interesting question. I have not shot trap. Oh, there's a lot of stuff in the book that I haven't done. For instance, I'm a vegetarian and they're constantly eating, you know, steamed liver and all the things that they eat in Victoria, you know, mussels and cockles. And so, no, I've never shot trap. I would do it, though. I think it seems fun. Yeah.
I used to load it and pull it.
Really?
So I'm just pulling out the little bits that interest me. This is all about me, of course.
No, of course. You and Kat Golay.
Yeah. Now, have you ever had to consult professional detectives during your research or writing phases?
I am so jealous of, like, Michael Connelly goes on ride-alongs with the LAPD and stuff, but I can't go unless I'm working on a time machine, but it's not ready. Until I do that, I can't go back and go on a ride-along. So, no, I haven't talked to detectives. I do read about, like, poisons, and I try to do my research and be good, but no, I would love to do that. Maybe I should write something set in 2018 for once.
Who named the book?
My friend John, did you look at the acknowledgments?
I did.
My friend John is a Hollywood screenwriter. He's the author of the movie Dirty Grandpa with Robert De Niro and Zac Efron. And we were all idly talking one day and I was like, I really need a name for this book. And he was like, what about The Woman in the Water? And my publisher was just like, that's the one. That's great. That's perfect. So all of my other friends read my books or of my closest friends, the week they come out, and he's 3 or 4 years behind.
I was wondering why you said you'll be reading it roughly in 2021.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I was talking to my daughter this morning about this book and about the main character, and I don't want to compare Lennox to anybody else, but as I was reading this, I was thinking somewhat a little bit about Holmes.
Definitely.
And Agatha Christie's Poirot. And then I was continuing on, and my daughter said, Nancy Drew.
You know, the Babysitter's Club was a surprisingly huge influence on me. I'm not going to lie.
Those other two authors that I mentioned, I mean, they've had a long history, a long track record. And this is a fairly new series. But do you feel like there's hope for Lennox to join those inspectors, those detectives, and the Detective Hall of Fame eventually?
Definitely not. Those guys are so good, Agatha Christie and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. If I could just be in the foothills of the mountain that they're on, I would be happy. But no, there's a great Raymond Chandler quote that the perfect mystery can't be written because the kind of brain that can come up with a perfect puzzle can't write a great novel. And I think both of those writers are as close as you can get to having the two sides meet, especially Doyle, who was so good at the puzzles and also created this beautiful, wonderful atmosphere that's the inspiration for my books. And just for sheer puzzle making, Christie was so brilliant. I mean, she fools me, even though I've read the books before, she sometimes fools me because I forget which one it is. And I'm like, oh, wait, was it that person? So no, I do not think that I will ever join them, but hopefully I can be myself for a little while.
You were awarded the Nona Balakian Citation for Excellence in Reviewing for the 2017 National Book Critics Circle Awards. And you were also a finalist in that same category in 2014. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Yeah, that was one of the most surprising days of my life. It was really thrilling. And I was, you know, my mom got to see me in the New York Times, so.
You've reviewed books for the New York Times Book Review, USA Today, the Chicago Tribune. Any others?
Lots of places. Slate, oh, The Guardian, right. The Washington Post. So I sort of all over the place. The New Yorker's online stuff I write for occasionally.
I listened to a conversation that you had in 2016 with Pamela Paul on the Inside the New York Times Book Review podcast. And I really want that to be named Behind the Times. I don't know why.
But then they would sound like they were behind the times.
I know.
Ahead of the times, maybe? Or I don't know, but that doesn't work either. You're right.
We'll leave it the way it
Let's
is.
Let's keep brainstorming, and then they'll definitely listen to us.
If I remember right, she was asking you how you decide which books to review, and you told her you'd rather write something positive than negative. And I think you said you read early chapters. Do you just abandon them then if you don't feel like you're going to be able to write something positive?
That's a good question. I think a reviewer, it's really important to reserve the right to write a negative review. And sometimes I'm just assigned a book and it's not good and I give it a very bad review. I think when you do that, you have to venture 85% into the writer's territory. You have to be absolutely sure that you know what's going on in their head and what they're trying to achieve before you give a bad review. And once you know, you can write a really negative review. I've done it. But I would always rather advocate on behalf of something I love than slam something I dislike. And I prefer both of those to being neutral because sometimes you get a book and you're like, well, this was okay. But for instance, last year, I really loved this book, Improvement by Joan Silber, which was released by an independent press. And I wrote a really strongly favorable review of it for the Washington Post. And I think it gave the book a jolt. It's now being nominated for prizes and it's gone into further printings, I believe. And that's the best feeling you can have as a critic. I think that's what I meant, is when you're speaking on behalf of something that maybe doesn't have enough attention behind it.
And I think, to be fair, for this conversation, I think you were probably asked about the newest crop of maybe literary thrillers and you were like trying to provide some good reads or something.
Right. Totally. Okay. Yeah. Some beach reads.
Yeah. How do you balance being an author and a reviewer? I mean, have you ever been on the bad end of a bad review?
It's funny. They say you should never read your reviews. And I chase down every single last Goodreads review and I read them all. And I don't know why I do that to myself. But, you know, Toni Morrison said, I have to know what's going on. So ever since I read that she said that, I thought, well, if Toni Morrison's reading her reviews, I can read mine. the most frustrating is when you get a review that's like, one star wouldn't load on my Nook or something like that. How do I balance being a critic and a novelist? It's really an interesting conundrum because as a novelist, you want a feeling of spontaneity and of creativity, and you want it to flow out of you naturally because you want the book to have a feeling of life. Whereas as a critic, you use the analytical part of your brain. And if you use that part of your brain too much as a novelist, you can really wrap yourself around the axle. So it's a difficulty for me. But I'll say that it's taught me a huge amount about what's bad in novels. So that whole Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours thing, I feel like I've really run through so many books now reading as a critic that I have a clearer idea of what I want to do myself.
In that same conversation with Pamela Paul that I listened to that I mentioned earlier, you discussed how thriller writers often have to choose between pace and prose. And the Charles Lennox series is, you know, is just steeped in this great literary prose. Would you describe it as a thriller series or as something else?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I suppose a thriller, something happens to the main character, and a mystery, the main character happens to a something. So this is sort of more of a literary mystery series, I would hope, where nothing that Titanic or Galilean happens in Lennox's life. He might, you know, miss a lunch or have a fight with his, you know, partner or something, but it's not like the FBI is chasing him, which would be a classic like thriller premise. So I would say these are sort of more literary mysteries. Thrillers, when I think of a thriller, I think of something that's, as I think I might have said in that interview, I can't remember, I think of a book that's throwing the cannons overboard just to try to go as fast as possible, like a clipper ship that's just trying to, for pure speed. And I like that about thrillers. I love to read thrillers, but sometimes it leads to not the best writing. And writing is really important to me, so I take my time a little more in these books.
Some authors say that they can't read other work while they're working on their own, but you read more than 200 books a year. You read for a living. Do you continue to write during that time, or what is the process? Because you've published 12 books in 11 years.
Yeah, it's I think I'm lucky in that I am able to create a firewall between what I read and what I write. For the most part, I mean, sometimes I'll read something that's really profoundly stirring. Like when I read the Elena Ferrante series for the first time, it affected my writing because it was so precise and yet so torrential. And that is really hard to attain as a writer. Usually you can either have polish or you can have kind of a flow, an imperfect flow. And she had both. And that really threw me. I was like, how is she doing this? And I had to go back and I reread the series and I wrote about it. But for the most part, I can balance reading and writing in my mind. My grandmother wrote books too, and she said when she was in the last stages of a book, she would only read Ivanhoe by Sir Walter Scott because it was the most boring novel she knew. And I think there are writers who are like that, who need to just have white bread for dinner when they're really at the end stages. But I'm usually able to cordon off my reading from my writing.
We have talked about a lot. Is there anything you'd like to add that we haven't talked about?
What have we not talked about? Well, I think that one thing that maybe is interesting is that Wichita has this amazing reputation among authors, because I know so many writers, and we get together and we have lunch and we complain about our editors and we complain about how much money we get paid for things, and word gets around about cities, and Wichita is one of those cities where everyone's like, well, that you have to go there, of course, you know, when you're on your book tour. And, you know, I'm going to New York and Chicago and St. Louis and Kansas City and a few other places, and I knew that I had to come to Wichita because the community that you and that watermark have built here is really no joke. It's rare to find a city that cares so much about books, so I'm honored to be here.
That was Charles Finch, author of the book The Woman in the Water, which was published by Minotaur. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover new episodes at kmuw.org or subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. And if you enjoy this podcast, consider leaving a rating or review on iTunes to help us spread the love. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our editor is Luann Stevens, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.